Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the political trends shaking the foundations of both the Republican and Democratic parties that suggest there is worse to come, and that this critical election year may be eclipsed by an even more important election year in 2020. John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, joins us to discuss his latest article at Tom Dispatch, "The Most Important Election of Your Life Is Not This Year," and the possibility that even if Donald Trump goes down in flames in November, Trumpism and the electoral anger that fuels it is likely to live on. Furthermore, Pfeffer argues that a more skillful and presentable Republican candidate along the lines of a more likable Ted Cruz could emerge and capture the movement and ride into Washington as a much more ominous retrograde political force. Then we'll look into the economics of empathy and speak with Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California who served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. He joins us to discuss his latest TEDx talk, "Searching for Our Fiscal Soul," which makes clear this rich country, filled with anger and mired in inequality, is in need of salvation and could be redeemed if politicians would push for and the public would understand the value of a complementary economy in which government spending is reframed as purchasing investments and insurance, which the private sector cannot and will not do. Then finally, we will speak with Douglas Keith, the Katz Fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, who works primarily in the Democracy Program. He is the co-author of a new report at the Brennan Center, "Secret Spending in the State," and we will discuss how, since Citizens United, dark money has trickled down from presidential and congressional races to state legislatures and now to local government races, where the investments in campaigns can be small, but the rewards huge. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11 and Crusade 2.0. And his latest article at Tom Dispatch is "The Most Important Election of Your Life Is Not This Year." Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And John, obviously that's a very provocative title since we're so immersed in this election, and many have said that this election is the most critical in American history. People as diverse as Sean Hannity of Fox News and Sean Willens, the historian at Princeton. But here you are saying, no, it's not this year. So when is it the most important?
Well, it's not exactly clear when the next, whether it will be the next election in 2020 or sometime after that. But the reason I say that this year is not the most important election is because Donald Trump, who everyone, anyone from the left of Hillary Clinton, sees as essentially the Antichrist, is mobilizing as we speak to defeat him in the November elections. But he basically is a very weak candidate. And not only is he a weak candidate, not only does he alienate enormous sections of the population, but even if he were, by some immense alignment of the stars, to manage to win the election in the fall, he would be up against such enormous resistance from even within his own party. Large sections of the Republican Party elite are very much arrayed against him. And of course, he'd face enormous Democratic Party resistance, but he'd also face just general kind of intellectual elite resistance within Washington and within New York. So even if he were to win, which I really think is very low probability, I don't think he would have very much effect on American political and economic structures. However, the population that is leaning towards Trump could very well be, say, mobilized by a far more effective, charismatic candidate that articulates many of the positions that Donald Trump articulates, but without any of the negatives. And I see that potential candidate essentially either coming out of a new party or out of some completely refashioned Republican Party or even possibly a Democratic Party, but representing essentially a neo-fascist politics here in the United States.
Well, that was the very candidate that people were worried about in this election cycle, who Trump managed to neutralize, of course, was Ted Cruz, who's as far to the right as you could possibly be, is a very smart guy, but a deeply cynical guy, and he'd be perfectly happy. In fact, he was pandering to the Tea Party people, the same people that have flocked to Trump.
Absolutely. And it's conceivable that Ted Cruz could come back in 2020, and he's certainly young enough even to come back in 2024. But he, too, alienates enormous sections of the population. I suspect that there'll be someone who embraces many of the positions that Ted Cruz and, in some sense, Donald Trump embrace, but without, at least overtly, being such an enormously contentious candidate. Someone who has much smoother edges, someone who is much, at least superficially, nicer within the American context, but who has just as virulent a set of positions that are consistent with Tea Party positions as Ted Cruz has now.
And again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of Crusade 2.0. And his latest article at Tom Dispatch is "The Most Important Election of Your Life Is Not This Year." So, John, you're suggesting then that Trumpism, this tremendous discontent that has swept Trump to the leadership of the Republican Party, and a similar kind of discontent has also swept Bernie Sanders forth as a serious contender in the Democratic race. But of course, the difference between Trump and Sanders are between night and day. Sanders actually believes in the issues that he's raised, and his record all of his life indicates that he's been the underdog fighting for the middle class and working Americans, whereas Trump is a self-promoting con man, fraud businessman, in quotes, who's just taking these people for a ride. So when Trump, and if Trump, crashes and burns, presumably he'll get wiped out in this election, you're saying that Trumpism is going to live on, even though the people that have flocked to his banner will be burned by him, just as the those people who enrolled in Trump University were burned by him.
Yes, you're absolutely right that Bernie Sanders has tapped into much of the same discontent that Trump has, but as you point out, Sanders has been legitimately a leader in kind of being a spokesperson for the working class and in some sense even the middle class. What I think the challenge is here in the United States is that ordinarily the kind of discontent that I'm speaking about in the electorate, what I refer to in the article as America B, and I refer to the electorate section as America B because I'm making a comparison to what has taken place in Poland. And essentially, there are two kind of streams of Polish population since 1989, since the transformations that took place in that country after the collapse of communism, Poland A and Poland B. Poland A effectively has been advantaged by the changes, has economically improved their position. Poland B has not. Poland B tends to be more rural, tends to be less educated, tends to be more working class, tends to be in one part of the country, the area of the country closer to the former Soviet Union. There are a number of ways of characterizing Poland A and Poland B. We tend not to think that here in the United States we've gone through a similar transformation in our economy, but in fact we have. The same kinds of global changes that have affected the Polish economy has affected the American economy as well. And we, too, have an enormous group of people who have not benefited from any of those changes. They've seen their wages drop precipitously. They've had to take on additional jobs. They've been unemployed, haven't been able to get jobs. And they are angry. And they're angry because the elites, and I'm talking about liberal and conservative elites, have abandoned them. They've seen both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party gravitate toward policies that promote economic winners. The Democratic Party, the kind of new Democratic Party of Bill Clinton in the 1990s, really promoted the end of welfare, trying to, help out those economic winners with tax policies. And, of course, we know very clearly what happened in the Republican Party, first under Ronald Reagan and then accelerated under George W. Bush. So elites of both parties have effectively failed America B. And the question is, who will America B vote for? If we had a socialist party or a labor party in the United States, they would naturally gravitate toward that party because the socialist party would say, hey, you know, we believe in redistributive policies. We believe in policies that really help out those who have not been able to make it on their own in the new economy. But we don't have a socialist party. We don't have a labor party. Bernie Sanders was the closest thing perhaps we've gotten in several generations to that kind of politics. And he did attract clearly a huge number of people, but it wasn't sufficient. In comparison, Donald Trump is offering an entirely different kind of politics, a politics which isn't actually connected to even a consistent program. I mean, Donald Trump will one day say that he wants to preserve Medicare and Social Security, next day say, well, we may have to put that on the chopping block. One day he'll say, oh, we have to go after those hedge fund managers. The next day he'll say, well, you know, actually, we really do need to cut taxes for the rich. So he doesn't actually have a consistent politics that you can kind of identify as being liberal or conservative. Rather, he has politics of resentment, and that resentment is clearly defined in his positions on immigrants, on women, on those groups which are perceived by many in the population as having taken away our jobs or taken away our benefits, our economic benefits.
Well, in your article, John Pfeffer, you say that Donald Trump, politically speaking to his followers, is the Powerball ticket. I mean, it's all aspirational. There's no reality there, and there's no way this guy is going to deliver on his promises, even if he gets a chance to become president. And again, Bernie Sanders was the authentic candidate of the very issues that Trump supporters are angry about. And I think that the one thing that seems to be in common with both the American electorate in terms of Bernie Sanders supporters going forward, whether or not they'll vote in November, was also being demonstrated in the recent Brexit vote in the UK. Obama went over there to inspire the young people because they were afraid they weren't going to vote to remain in Europe, which is the position that the young have. They're more integrated into Europe and less nostalgic for the empire as the older folks in Britain. And guess what? The young kids didn't show up to vote. They were maybe at Glastonbury or somewhere, but they didn't vote. And the fear in this country is that the young Sanders voters or supporters aren't going to vote as well.
I think that is a very important fear, in part because young people also feel as if no one speaks to their issues, that the elite is not concerned about the next generation, not interested in improving education, improving employment opportunities. So who can blame them if they feel that certainly Donald Trump doesn't speak to them, but neither does Hillary Clinton. And certainly we see in Europe a very similar kind of trend. Even though, of course, Europe, either the Labour Party in England or, say, the Communist Party in France. There you had parties to mobilize, to organize, that traditionally, you know, working class voters gravitated toward. But we've seen over the last 10 to 20 years a shift of in areas where the Labour Party or the Communist Party in France were quite strong, you see many of the people in that electoral base not switch to, say, you know, Socialist Party or a Social Democratic Party in England. Rather, they've gone over to the complete other side of the political spectrum, which would be the UK Independence Party in England or the National Front in France. In other words, they see those parties, those extreme right parties, as articulating their positions far more effectively than what had been their kind of natural base of political operations. And that, I think, is a concern here as well. People who would naturally gravitate toward a Democratic Party, even one that was that had a compromised candidate like Hillary Clinton, would decide instead to abandon the party entirely, much as the voters in Europe who would, you know, be on the left have moved entirely over to the far right. And voters here in the United States would embrace a wild card like Donald Trump, someone who is effectively a joker in the pack, someone who does not have a consistent set of political positions. And because here in the United States we are, you know, essentially an individualistic society, people here believe that they will be the anointed one, in much the same way that Donald Trump anoints people in his reality TV show. He chooses from among the apprentices and says, aha, you are the one who will earn the riches, as in a fairy tale, or as in a lottery. And in this case, you know, people vote for Donald Trump because they think of him as being a Powerball winner, you know, someone who can magically transform their lives on an individual basis, rather than a political candidate who can transform a group of people, a social class, by virtue of consistent political policies.
Well, but is this to say then that the establishment, the 1%, are going to live on, that the hope that Bernie Sanders was bringing was that he was a real threat to Wall Street? Donald Trump isn't. He may have taken down a bunch of Wall Street bankers who have long memories, but they'll live with him. They certainly won't live with Bernie, and they will live with Hillary. So just in the last couple of minutes, John Pfeffer, give us a broader picture of where do you think, if you think that the 2020 elections are going to be more important, and if the people that have followed Trump can find a more charismatic and less erratic candidate, then they pose a greater danger to the United States. Is that to say that this country is going to continue to go to the right? Or what happened to that moment where the word socialism ceased to be a dirty word and Bernie Sanders was talking to millions of people?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think the Sanders campaign is, you know, making some very wise choices right now. It's pursuing a kind of dual strategy. One is to transform the Democratic Party through its platform by kind of introducing elements like minimum wage, pushing for a financial transaction tax, that can shift the Democratic Party in the direction that Bernie Sanders was articulating. And the second and perhaps more important effort is to recruit a number of candidates who can run on Sanders' positions and kind of repopulate American politics at the local, the state, and the national level, which is, you know, frankly, what needs to be done. It's not, even if Bernie Sanders had somehow managed to get the Democratic nomination and then became president, he would not have been able to implement his plans with only a small handful of supporters in Congress and outside of Congress. So, you know, the Sanders revolution really requires this much larger transformation of leadership. If that can be done, both at the platform level and at the level of personnel, then yes, of course, 2020 or 2024, we will see a shift in American politics to the left. If that effort fails, then the energy that the Sanders campaign has tried to mobilize, I'm afraid, might be captured by this potentially right-wing charismatic candidate who will make some kind of accommodation with Wall Street in the same way that I see, a candidate like Donald Trump attempting to make as well. It will be a different kind of Republican Party or a different kind of American politics under such a right-wing populist leader. But it would be very dangerous in my estimation because it wouldn't be rooted in the actual lived experience of, as I call it, America B, but it would be entirely created from the illusions and fantasies of that subsection of the American population.
Well, John Pfeffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as the associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11 and Crusade 2.0. And his latest article at Tom Dispatch is The Most Important Election of Your Life is Not This Year. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the economics of empathy and the search for our fiscal soul.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people. I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
It's the money,
money, money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, Ed served as Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, and he just gave a TED Talk titled Searching for Our Fiscal Soul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Ian, thanks very much. And just to be clear, it was a TEDx talk, but I appreciate the opportunity.
So let us deal then straight to the heart of your TEDx talk, Searching for Our Fiscal Soul. That is obviously an interesting paradox. The idea of fiscal and soul aren't normally, they don't normally go together. But my understanding is that the study of economics used to be tied in intimately to the human condition, and it had a moral component. But of late, I guess, certainly in the 20th and 21st centuries, it became more of a numbers-crunching exercise. So let's start with that premise.
I think that that's right. If you go back and read Adam Smith, you must remember that he was the author of two very important books. One was The Wealth of Nations. The other was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and I believe that they were designed to complement one another. The Theory of Moral Sentiments was how we learn to internalize good moral values, and The Wealth of Nations was how we go about becoming a more successful country. But the presumption in Wealth of Nations is that people were the mature souls that he envisioned in Theory of Moral Sentiments.
So let's start with the unfortunate reality, as you point out in your TED talk. We are a rich country filled with anger. We are also a rich country filled with inequality. So are those two related? They would seem to be.
Yes, absolutely. And you need, I think, to slice it at different levels. If you chart the growth of our national income over the last 30 years, obviously we had a significant dip in the 2008 recession, but in general, there's a steady march up in the income of the country as a whole. When you then look at the wages of full-time, year-round male workers, you discover that they have not received a pay raise in inflation-adjusted terms in over 30 years. In inflation-adjustment terms, they are putting the same amount or even a little less in their pockets for the median, for the middle-of-the-pack worker that he was putting in his pocket 30 years ago. And that is not how America used to operate. That's a source of great frustration. At the same time, if you look at measures of poverty, well, you discover that the most recent estimate, we have 45 million Americans living in poverty. And if you compare the United States to other affluent countries, what you discover is that we have the worst inequality numbers of any major wealthy economy. We have the highest number of adults in living in poverty of any of the major countries, and we have the biggest gap between rich and poor. If you think Norway, the top 10% of the population makes about six times what the bottom 10% makes. In Canada, it's nine times. In the United States, it's 16 times. And when you put that together, when you think in particular about how the middle of the pack worker, male worker, has not seen a wage increase in his pocket to spend at the local tavern in 30 years, you explain an awful lot of presidential politics.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He was former chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he recently gave a TEDx talk, Searching for Our Fiscal Soul. So given what you're telling us is not just the facts of the moment, it's also the trajectory you are on, isn't it, Ed? I mean,
yes.
It's getting worse. It's not getting better, in other words.
Absolutely. Go back to my point that national income and in inflation-adjusted terms, so that we're not dealing with inflation, the country as a whole has gotten richer. Our income has gone up over the last 30 years. Our poverty rates are terrible, and the middle-of-the-pack worker isn't seeing more cash in his pocket. So the simple question is, where's the money going? And the answer, of course, is the top 1%. And the irony is that actually the top 1% is just as aggrieved as you and I are, Ian, because what they see is the top 1% of the 1% pulling away further from them, the top 1/10,000th of Americans. And that's the extraordinary thing about the trajectory that we're on, is that the very, very, very top end, the top 1/10,000th of Americans, is pulling away from the 1%. The 1% is pulling away from the rest of us. And there's nothing to indicate that those trends are moderating.
Well, it's pretty clear that the U.S. had some form of social democracy from, say, 1944 to 1977. And you mentioned American workers' particularly white working men, have not had a raise since the 1970s. And then with Ronald Reagan's arrival came the canard that big government is the problem, that we simply have to get rid of government and let the private sector take care of everything. And that argument has been very powerful, and it's been largely accepted, even though it's totally the wrong argument, surely. The argument should be whether we have better government. I mean, in other words, in social democracies like Norway that you mentioned, that has a much better distribution of income, you get what you pay for, that the citizen understands you pay your taxes and you get your government services, and that the government is supposed to be a good steward of your tax money and provide you value for money. What value for money do we get from our taxation, even though it's amongst the lowest in the world? The only things that we get back are Social Security and Medicare for elderly Americans, and those are under assault. And I just find it extraordinary that there hasn't been any pushback, particularly by the Democrats, against this canard of big government being the problem, when if the debate were about better government, the American people would demand a better government.
That's exactly what I mean by our fiscal soul, and the point of the talk and the book. What we need to get back to is what I call a complementary economy, one in which we respect the private sector, but where we understand that the private sector by itself cannot satisfy all of our needs, cannot offer all of the services that are required, and that there is an important role for government in investment and insurance that simply cannot be replicated in the private sector, and that it makes us richer and happier. And the complementary economy, I think, captures that theme. The way I see things, democracy, you know, is an exercise in empathy for people we don't know and whom we might, if we did know, might not like, you know, our fellow Americans. And the way we express that, and this is what I mean by our fiscal soul, the way we express that empathy we feel for all of us being in this together, all of us as Americans, is through government spending, which is financed by government taxes. That's my connection to people in Athens, Georgia, or Schenectady, New York, whom I otherwise might not have any connection to. And when you start thinking in those terms, you see these wonderful investment opportunities and insurance opportunities that are just going begging. And when you look at the tax side of things and say, how could we possibly afford to do more by way of the public side of the complementary economy, what you discover is exactly what you just said, Ian, which is that the United States, you know, is the lowest taxed major wealthy economy in the world. We average about 26% of our national income for all taxes, including California taxes. Germany, it's 36%. That's what funds the government investment and insurance. And the great thing about government investment is that it is almost by definition, broadly available. It helps everyone further down the income distribution than does the return to private investment. My joke in the book is that not even President Bush proposed the No Polo Fields Left Behind Act.
Well, then I don't see, you know, Bernie Sanders certainly introduced the issue of fairness and how money in our politics have distorted our politics to the point where basically Wall Street appears to own Washington. And, you know, in a country's history, there have been two centers of power, certainly the financial center in New York and the political center in Washington. But by and large, Washington seems to have been in charge. And I'm not sure that the tables haven't turned on that. But for example, I think if Hillary Clinton had the imagination to offer up a program for the American people, rather like the victory bonds during World War II, that you could have sort of U.S. savings bonds. And that the point is that the average American, particularly seniors, have nowhere to save money. The banks used to pay you interest, and now they charge you interest. And all of those poor people with 401ks, after the Brexit vote and the turmoil on the market, billions and billions were lost. So the people have been forced into the stock market to get some kind of savings. And even that is pretty dodgy. And the Republicans are just trying to stop the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from demanding that people that give investment advice to seniors have to act in the fiduciary interest of the seniors and not gouge them with unnecessary fees. I mean, it's extraordinary to think that the Republican Party is actually standing up for the rights of Wall Street to rip off seniors. But these are the facts that we're living with today. And I just don't understand why nobody's coming forth with a plan, a simple plan to allow Americans to save money.
Well, what you've made is a great point, and it has sort of two parts to it. One is sort of above market interest rates to seniors or other individuals in small denominations to give them an effective savings outlet that is more secure than the stock market, in which we all know about its volatility. But the other, of course, is that there's just lots for government to do with that money. And that is what really needs to be emphasized, because it requires a reorientation on the part of how all of us think about government, thanks to the nearly 40 years of sort of poisoning of the idea of a positive role to government since about 1980. And so we need to grasp the principle of a complementary economy, and then we have to demand that of our congresspeople. When I listen to some of the members of Congress, and you know, there's sort of a race for who's the dumbest, but when I listen to some of them, I just feel embarrassed for their constituents. And so the way Washington changes is not from the inside out, it's from the outside in. It's the American people saying, you know, we've had enough. We need, in fact, for government to invest here. We need for to invest in infrastructure, to invest in education, to invest in early childhood daycare and health care, because we're ashamed of being a country that is the wealthiest large economy in the world and also one with the greatest inequality within the country, and because we want, in fact, to recognize that all Americans are tied to one another, and the mechanism that creates those binds is government, and in particular, how it spends its money and how it taxes.
But the current spasm of anger that you see, particularly on the supporters of Donald Trump, where they're just mad as hell, and Trump, of course, is a huckster and a hoax, who's sort of offering them the political equivalent of winning the Powerball lottery, and they're not going to win. If anybody wins, he wins, and that's how his career has been. He makes money, and other people that invest in him lose money. That's the established record. So you couldn't have a worse sort of leader of this movement of populist discontent. So is there a way to sort of capture that, all of that populist discontent, in a positive way? I mean, again, I get back to Hillary Clinton. She should be the one that's making this argument, or somebody should be the one that's making this argument, because, frankly, I find it really tragic that so many people in America are angry for the right reasons, but they're going to get ripped off by Donald Trump.
Well, I agree with what you just said. I think the theme that people need to assimilate is the idea that when we have a progressive income tax and that's functioning, and a robust, muscular government that's making the right kind of investments, that doesn't mean that money has been piled up on a table and set on fire. What it means is that some of us are investing in all of us. And that's what people need to demand. They need to demand that we use the mechanism of government productively so that some of us who've won the lottery of life are investing more in all of us, by which I mean public education, infrastructure. I mean, just take infrastructure, old-fashioned infrastructure projects. They have financial returns. In fact, the CBO estimates that when the federal government spends, the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan arbiter of these things, they estimate that when the federal government spends money on infrastructure investments, those investments throw off a return of about 8% a year. Well, when the government can borrow at 2%, that's just money that we're leaving lying on the table. So we need a mechanism by which some of us can invest in all of us. And I do wish that Secretary Clinton could capture that theme a little bit more vividly and communicate it with the, right. frankly, with the power that Senator Sanders was able to get his message out.
Well, just in closing, of course, had President Obama asked for a stimulus package back in 2008, 2009, when the economy crashed, the one that Christine Romer, for example, put forth, instead of taking half a loaf and half of what was needed, and we've made this long, slow, painful recovery, which many people don't see as a recovery, had he asked for what it would have taken to get America back again, this recession would have ended a long time ago and we'd be so much better off today. So the proof is there, surely. I mean, I don't see any evidence to refute that, is there?
Well, I agree. In fact, again, the Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan economic experts, works hand in glove with my old outfit, the Joint Committee on Taxation staff. The Congressional Budget Office has done study after study of the economic effects of the Reinvestment Act and demonstrated that it, in fact, created millions of jobs and made the country better off. And yet, despite that, despite the objective proof, we're still trapped in this false prison of our own making, that government remains the problem and that we can't afford for government to do anything because we'll have terrible deficits, when in fact borrowing at 2% to invest at 8% means that you're making money and the country's getting richer and can afford to pay that loan back with ease. So it's a very perverse prison of our own devices that we've found ourselves in.
Well, Edward Kleinbart, I thank you very much for joining us on this 4th of July weekend. I appreciate it.
Take care now, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as the Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, and he recently gave a TEDx talk, Searching for Our Fiscal Soul. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking how dark money has trickled down from presidential and congressional races to state legislatures and now to local government races.
What have we done? Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Douglas Keith, the Katz Fellow at the Brennan Center, working primarily on the Democracy Program. He has worked on voting rights in New York and as an organizer served on several international election observation missions for the National Democratic Institute and the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights, and trained poll workers for the New York City Board of Elections. He is the co-author of a new report at the Brennan Center, Secret Spending in the States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Keith.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we're learning here that from your new report at the Brennan Center, Secret Spending in the States, that there's a sort of dark money is trickling down, not just from the presidential and congressional races, but all the way down to the Utility Commission in Arizona. So we saw from 2010 and 2014 midterms that the Republicans were making a special effort to win the states and get a lot of legislation done at the state level. And the Koch brothers have backed a group called ALEC that does exactly that. But in effect, since Citizens United, it's not just that the dark money has migrated to the state level. It's also pretty much at the county level now as well, isn't it?
Yes, we're seeing it at both the state and local level. Counties, city school boards, anywhere where there is an interest, particularly an economic interest, that could affect a party's bottom lines. These are races where, I would say even more than at the federal level, economic interests of particular entities are really at play, and those folks know it, and this is a place where, because state races cost significantly less than federal races, you can spend a little bit of money but have a big impact.
And isn't it usually the case that in these local elections, very few people vote?
Turnout, especially when these local elections take place at times that are different than federal elections, is lower. And I think it's also important that not only is turnout lower, but voters just know less about these candidates. The press is paying limited attention to these races, as are individuals, and understandably, there's only so much we can keep up with. But again, because these races cost less and because voters have less information, a little bit of outside spending can really go a long way.
And the study that you co-authored at the Brennan Center, Douglas Keith, it covered six states following the 2010 Citizens United decision: Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Maine, and Massachusetts. Together, they have about 20% of the nation's population. And the study found that on an average, there is 38 times more dark money was spent in these states in 2014 than in 2006. And the Center for Responsive Politics found that 34 times, an increase of 34 times over that same period for federal races as well. So that's clearly, it's pretty hard to deny the cause and effect there in terms of Citizens United, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it's stronger than just trickling down to the states. It's growing more quickly at the state level, at least dark money is. And in 2006, we found that 76 cents of every dollar of outside political spending in these six states was pretty much transparent. A voter or a journalist or anyone interested could find out with relative ease who was supporting outside political ads. By 2014, that was true of only 29 cents of outside spending. The drop in transparency is dramatic, and it's both dark money and something we call in the report we label as gray money, which is money that's technically transparent. It's a PAC, political action committee, that's spending a lot or a little bit of money. But if you pulled up their filings, instead of individual donors' names, you'd just find the names of other PACs. And so maybe you could keep digging and go down the line and figure out where that money originally came from. But for all intents and purposes, that spending we don't find to be transparent, because it's not going to be that information is rarely, if ever, going to get to the voters. And this is these groups that collect these large contributions and engage in only outside spending were empowered by the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United.
So again, you mentioned earlier, Douglas Keith, that these the trickle-down of dark money from the federal to the state races and now to local races, in many ways, the investments can be small in local races, but the rewards can be huge. Here's an example. A Utah legislative investigation found that a candidate for state attorney general in 2012, John Swallow, hung up a veritable for sale sign on his office door. An aide arranged for a payday loan company to fund about $450,000 in dark money ads in exchange for John Swallow's promise to shield the payday lenders from consumer protection laws. The voters at the time obviously were completely unaware of this. Swallow won, but then resigned after less than a year in office, and he now faces trials on unrelated corruption charges. So is this the kind of cause and effect that you open the floodgates of money in politics without attribution and all kinds of sleazebags come forth to simply make money out of a system that's based on money?
I think we shouldn't be surprised that when these races are going to impact companies or other groups' bottom lines, that they're going to make a determination that they can spend a little bit of money. They won't risk their reputation because they can mostly stay private, and they can end up reaping a great economic reward for that small investment. And we've seen this in the report. We found examples of this across the country. There's a ballot initiative in Idaho, which would have increased the state's requirement for online education as part of their high school education requirements. And it turns out that ballot initiative was being supported by someone who's made great profits off of investing in online education companies. Contributed about, if I remember, about $250,000, but probably stood to make a fair deal more than that if the ballot initiative had passed. And with these state and local races where we elect regulators that have a more direct impact on economic interests, we vote on ballot measures that impact state spending, it's to be expected that people will make this determination that it's worth it for them to get involved, especially when they never have to put their names out in the open.
Well, I don't remember which one of the amendments to the Constitution, I think maybe it's the 13th or the 15th, but prior to that amendment, senators from states were elected by local legislatures. And local legislatures were notoriously corrupt, particularly basically in the pocket of the big railroad barons and et cetera, at the time of the Gilded Age and the robber barons, you know. And that amendment, so that senators were directly elected by the people instead of chosen by the legislature, of course, has changed the whole nature of the Senate. Up to that, prior to that, it was just a bazaar of corruption. So the assumption's always been that the smaller the government, the easier it is to buy it. Does that still hold sway?
I'm not sure that we can speak to that. I think they're a good example of state and local legislatures across the country. I think that what I'm more concerned about here is not so much the legislators themselves, but the spenders who are getting involved for their own economic benefit. It often happens when the people they're spending on behalf of don't even know. There's a good example of this in California, a Mountain View City Council race in 2014, a group which, after the election, voters learned was the California Apartment Owners Association, funded a group called the Neighborhood Empowerment Coalition, which sounds well-intentioned, but supported three candidates for Mountain View City Council because they, it appears, believe that they would be supportive of their views on rent control and land use in Mountain View, two issues that were central to that election. But the some of the people who were most upset by this spending were the people who were supported themselves. Those candidates report that they didn't know where this money was coming from. They were embarrassed to be seen as the candidates that were being supported by these shadowy groups, and that they would have preferred to have just run the normal races in Mountain View, which consist of knocking on doors and speaking to community groups. So I would point the blame more at the spenders seeking to hide their names than at the legislators they're supporting.
Right, but the assumption is that they're giving the money in the hope of a quid pro quo. Of course, we might add that just a few days ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled in the case of the corruption case against the governor of Virginia in an 8-0 ruling in favor of acquitting the governor on corruption charges. And the ruling was based upon the idea that Governor McDonald, while he did accept Ferraris and private jet travel and all kinds of goodies that he and his wife accepted from this food supplement guy that was trying to get the state to essentially pay for the FDA tests to make some of his products available and get the seal of approval of the FDA, the Supreme Court ruled that as long as there wasn't a direct quid pro quo, in other words, you get the money from somebody and then you pass the legislation that favors that entity, then it's okay. So to my mind, you know, the bar has been set pretty low. It's okay to get gifts from people who are trying to bribe you as long as you don't pass a law directly favoring them. What was your impression of that recent Supreme Court ruling?
Well, I can't speak in great detail to it, but I do think the big message is that we're not going to be able to, we can't pass off our desire to control money in politics to the prosecutors. We're not going to be able to convict or prosecute our way out of this problem. We need real campaign finance reform that applies to everyone before Election Day, not after Election Day when particular problems have been found out.
Well, Douglas Keith, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Douglas Keith, who's the Katz Fellow at the Brennan Center, working primarily on in the Democracy Program, and he has worked on voting rights in New York and as an organizer served on several international election observation missions for the National Democratic Institute and the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. And he trained poll workers for the New York City Board of Elections and is the co-author of a new report from the Brennan Center, Secret Spending in the States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow. Bye for now. Whoa.